Good morning, all. Calling the meeting to order and welcome you on this bright day. We have minutes from February 20. Representative Long, are you prepared for the minutes?
Yes, I'd like to move the minutes, please.
The minutes have been moved for February 20. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Minutes are adopted. Representative Long, we have your House File 3368. Representative Long, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 3368 be laid over.
Thank you, Representative Long. Moves House File 3668 that will likely be laid over because there's so many amendments. Representative Long, you have an DE2 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the DE2. This is to put the bill in the form I would like it. We have a vehicle bill here that Senator Osmak and I agreed to be our vehicle. And this is putting the House position in the bill.
This is the author's amendment for a DE2. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any objection? The amendment is adopted. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also have an author's amendment. Would you like to do that now or later?
And that is?
A-19.
Representative Long moves House A-19.
A-19 is just a technical amendment making fixes to the bill that were caught after the DE was posted.
A-19 is a technical amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment is adopted. Would you like to walk through your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, we heard our community solar bill last year, so I think members of this committee are familiar with it. But put it in a little bit of context and then talk a little bit about this new draft. Minnesotans, as we know and as we've heard in this committee, are concerned about climate change, and they want options to be able to take action in their own life to promote renewable energy. Community solar allows subscribers who would not otherwise install solar to take advantage of renewable energy. And Minnesota has the most successful community solar program in the country. Since we passed our community solar law in 2013 under Speaker Hortman's leadership, Minnesota has installed over 98% of its solar capacity. Minnesota's community solar program hit a record 656 megawatts of operational capacity last month. Currently, more than 12,000 Minnesota residential customers are saving money with a community solar subscription, and this accounts for 84% of all solar garden subscribers. If you want to look at the capacity subscribed, then nearly two-thirds of the total program capacity serves public entities. So these are schools, colleges, hospitals, and county and local governments, which helps to reduce their energy prices. The program has also meant local jobs for the Minnesotans who have installed these 656 megawatts of solar. It's been a huge success, but there have been many challenges. There's been a year after year debate at the Public Utilities Commission over many aspects of the program. And while we've seen many residential subscribers participate, there have been some challenges to increasing the percentage of residential subscribers. And we've also heard at this committee concerns raised by committee members in Excel about the cost of the community solar program. This bill is attempting to respond to some of these concerns. The bill builds off the draft we heard last year in committee and passed off the House floor and includes several provisions that members will recognize. This includes allowing projects to sell to subscribers in non-contiguous counties if they agree to sell to at least 10% residential subscribers and to a 100-foot setback from residential property. This is a provision that has previously passed the Senate in an overwhelming bipartisan vote. Another provision from last year is the establishment of a new program for community access projects. These projects are designed to help expand community solar access for low-income communities by adjusting the rate offering for projects that commit to serving low-income customers. And there are several new provisions of note. First, the bill includes a cap of 225 megawatts per year. This is a big, good faith concession on our part in hopes that it will allow us to reach an agreement to help stabilize the program. And to address the concern raised by Xcel and those on this committee, we propose shifting some solar development in the state to a new distributed generation program. This program would allow projects up to 10 megawatts, which would reduce costs by allowing for economies of scale. These projects would not have subscribers and would receive a lower rate from Xcel, so they would be less expensive to build and therefore would be able to be penciled out at a lower rate. The bill also has new consumer protection language, which we'd worked on with the Senate and as part of the vehicle bill that we agreed on with Senator Osmick. And this includes the right for subscribers to cancel a subscription within 3 days, a requirement that certain information be shared with the subscribers on the estimated length of time it would take to fully recover their investment, and in circumstances of prepayment for subscribers, would allow for the transfer or cancellation on commercially reasonable terms. I think we've had time to see what is working well with our community solar program and where we can make improvements. And as I mentioned, there's a companion vehicle bill in the Senate, and I'm hopeful we can get to conference this year to find a compromise that builds on the strengths of our program, that stabilizes it, and helps make it even more successful going future. And I'd like to invite up two testifiers, if you wouldn't mind, Madam Chair. I have a Professor Gabe Chan and David Schaefer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Long, and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify before you this morning. My name is Gabriel Chan. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs, but I'm here today in my own capacity as a researcher and private citizen. So this bill would amend aspects of Minnesota's Community Solar Garden Program and Xcel Energy Service Territory. This is the largest community solar program in the country. It was established in 2013, and at the end of 2019, there's 656 megawatts in commercial operation with an additional 256 in design, construction, and study. This represents more than half of all solar deployed in the state and is also larger than the previously planned solar deployment by 2020 that Xcel had announced in its last integrated resource plan. Nearly 16,000 of Xcel's residential customers and over 18,000 total customers participate as subscribers. I'd like to focus my comments this morning today on the costs of the program and the basis for these costs and the value of solar tariff. There's two related concerns that the Community Solar Garden Program has raised. The first is that the program is creating a cost shift between those Xcel customers who are able to subscribe to a garden and those who are not. And the second is that the program is forcing Xcel to purchase more expensive solar energy than it could get through other means, for example, through a competitive reverse auction. And so I'd like to address these two concerns in turn. First, is the community solar program creating a cost shift between subscribers and non-subscribers? So to answer this question, first, I think it's important to recognize that the framework under which community solar projects are compensated changed at the beginning of 2017. In the initial legislation authorizing the program, the first 2 years of projects, 2015 and 2016, were paid for, the energy that they generated was paid for under the so-called applicable retail rate. This was a rate higher than the regular rate Xcel customers paid, largely due to payments that were mandated for renewable energy credits that subscribers or developers could assign to Xcel. These credits allowed Xcel to comply with the state's solar energy standard. And in the initial 2 years, as the program got going, there's been a time lag. And so actually the majority of projects today still fall under the applicable retail rate for those projects that applied in 2015 and 16. But since 2017, all new projects in Xcel's community solar program are to be compensated under the value of solar tariff. This tariff has its origins in that same 2013 legislation that created the program and is by design an unsubsidized rate. An unsubsidized rate is one that compensates generators based on the value to the system that they created. This means that there's a very data-intensive process developed to calculate the cost that bringing on new solar generation avoids elsewhere on the system. There are eight main components of avoided costs within the value of solar tariff. including an estimate of the fuel that is avoided with new distributed solar deployment, an estimate of the power plant capital costs that are avoided with new distributed solar deployment, the avoided transmission and distribution system costs that are avoided with new distributed solar deployment, and also the environmental harms that are avoided with new distributed solar deployment. The approach in estimating the system costs that are avoided with new generation actually has a very long history, tracing back to at least the 1978 Federal Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act. So by basing compensation for generators on the costs that they avoid to the system, the value of solar framework is designed to pay distributed solar generators only for their fair share. The design is intended to protect those Xcel customers who are not subscribers from any adverse impacts from increasing distributed solar deployment. And in fact, the notion of avoided costs and the allocation of those avoided costs or cost to different generators and customers is a fundamental principle in all of utility rate making. For example, there's a very similar data-intensive process utilized in developing not just the value of solar tariff, but also rate making in general, in designing Minnesota's Conservation Improvement Program for energy efficiency, and for the Saver Switch Program for demand response. These processes are all based on the notion of a just and reasonable electricity system, but they're also very imperfect. And as such, Minnesotans already vary substantially in the extent to which they contribute their fair share, not just to generation, but to all aspects of the electricity system, from power plants to poles and wires, and including the community solar gardens. And so with all this said, by design, the community solar compensated under the value of solar does not impose a net cost on the system. Projects compensated under the initial framework of the applicable retail rate were paid more than their value, and I estimate that due to the way in which costs are recovered on the system, this is impacting non-subscribing Xcel customers at about 70 cents per month, or about a 0.8% increase in the typical residential customer bill. If environmental benefits are excluded from this calculation, this number rises to about $1.4 per month, or a 1.5% increase. But again, noting that moving forward, all projects moving after 2017 fall under the value of solar tariff, the net costs of the program are capped and will stop growing as all projects move to the unsubsidized rate. So now, as I turn to my second question, is the community solar program forcing Xcel to purchase more expensive solar energy than it could get through other means? We all know that the costs of solar energy are declining rapidly. The Solar Energy Industries Association estimates that the costs of solar have dropped 70% in the last decade. And in most places, renewables, including solar, are cheaper to build than any new fossil power plant. And so how can Minnesotans benefit from these declining prices? There are two primary ways. The first is through utility procurement processes based on seeking approval from the Public Utility Commission, usually through the integrated resource planning process. In this form, a utility conducts an analysis to establish a need for a resource based on complex modeling of forecasted demand and different cost assumptions. Typically, then, a utility will solicit bids for a particular resource type or open up bids for all resources. This approach can be very good for attracting lowest bidders for a fixed capacity amount. But that fixed capacity amount, that need, is subject to many of the exact same assumptions as in the value of solar tariff, for example, forecasts of future natural gas prices. And so it can be more difficult to properly value some of the values that different, particularly smaller, distributed generation can create, such as avoided costs to the distribution grid or environmental attributes. And so large requests for proposals may, in fact, be biased towards larger generation sources with more easily quantified benefits, and larger deployments may also be at risk for lock-in. Yet still, this ordinary utility planning process has been very effective, and probably the most effective way that Minnesotan utilities have so far brought on a high level of renewable energy quickly to keep electricity prices low and lower the state's carbon emissions. But the second approach to how Minnesotans can benefit from rapidly declining costs of renewables is through an accurate value of solar that enables participation for all energy customers to benefit. As previously stated, the value of solar is an unsubsidized rate that's based on a framework designed to impose no net costs on non-participants. As the costs of solar decline below the value of solar, it creates benefits, and so there's an opportunity created. The community solar program creates an opportunity for electricity customers to capture some of that benefit and to enjoy the increasingly favorable economics of solar. So in other words, the community solar program allows individuals to subscribe to a solar farm in a way that compensates them for helping to invest in an energy product that creates more value than it costs, just as with any other profitable enterprise. Applying the value of solar tariff to a broader set of solar projects can continue to protect non-participants so long as the values scale in proportion to the benefits. So that means that the larger projects that may require new grid infrastructure to support should not be compensated for any benefits that they don't actually create. Done accurately and fairly, the value of solar and a competitive solicitation based on integrated resource planning should achieve the exact same outcome if all benefits are properly accounted for. And so as the opportunity to benefit from the increasingly favorable economics of solar expands, it may also be important to keep in mind that this opportunity is created through a shared infrastructure system. And so it may also be important, therefore, to make sure that that opportunity to benefit from these economics are available to all. So ultimately, as utilities move to rapidly transition our energy system to achieve environmental goals and to seize the opportunity of rapidly changing renewable economics, the system will likely need all the solar energy that it can cost effectively get. Community solar and solar compensated through the value of solar can be an important complement to other forms of solar deployment as we move to transition the system. Thank you, and I welcome your questions.
Representative Spasinski, did you have your question now, or were you going to wait?
I can wait until those guys are done. That'd be fine, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members, my name is David Schaefer. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association, MNSEIA. We're a chapter of the National SEIA, and we have about 110 different solar companies that we represent in the state of Minnesota that are either located here or operating in the state. Those 110 companies have about 4,000 jobs in the state of Minnesota. This number does change a bit, and that tends to be with the success of the Community Solar Garden Program. The vast majority of those 4,000 workers are in the Community Solar Garden Program. They're either installing it, developing it, engineering it, or seeding pollinator habitat and similar things like that. So in general, this is the most successful program we have in the state of Minnesota for solar, but it's not the only one, which I'll get to in a second. Last year when we ran this bill, we got a lot of feedback from this body and the other body about some challenges that they may have seen with the Community Solar Garden Program. One of them was the price tag of the dollars per kilowatt hour. One was that the utility can't plan for this program. It's uncapped. And then another one that we saw was some challenges with consumer protections. So we've been working with Representative Long and some folks in the other body to see if we can't come up with some better language to ask you all to endorse here. And some of those ideas are, I believe, in this bill, as Representative Long has put forward. Some of the solutions that we've seen, the first one actually has to do with providing a separate venue for solar developers to participate in. Right now, there are a lot of options in the state of Minnesota for people to develop projects that are somewhere between 0 and 1 megawatt in size, but there is not a lot that you can do currently at a viable rate between 1 and 10 megawatts. So this language that's the distributed solar generation tariff would provide developers an opportunity to go above that 1 megawatt threshold and deliver solar to the grid at a much more affordable price by limiting the factors in the valuation to a smaller subset than what's currently under the value of solar. In exchange for removing the environmental value, it would give a REC adder that would then be transferable to other parties if they want to make green claims. And so this could be a viable market where, for instance, maybe Target wants to make some green claims about going 100% by 2030. They could buy the REC from this program and then legally make those claims. This would give a viable alternative pathway that then would permit this program to be capped at 225 megawatts and ensure that developers have a place where they can continue to grow the jobs in Minnesota in the solar industry while delivering a lower cost price to ratepayers. This idea may seem novel here, but it actually kind of already exists in a way. Back in 2002, I believe, the state under statute 216B1611 authorized the Public Utilities Commission to basically establish and create a distributed generation tariff. We have since that time learned quite a bit about the original draft of the DG tariff, and it's being reevaluated in docket 16-521 at the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. And what this would do is it basically says, you know what, we're going to just take the step forward, acknowledge that we're going to make this change today, to give the certainty to this program so that we can move forward with a 225 megawatt cap instead of having to wait for that process to yield what I believe will be a very similar result to what's in this bill here today. So that would create sort of a fourth bucket, if you will, for where solar can go, and the other buckets being rooftop community solar utility scale. So that is one direction where we can have a market-based solution where developers go and perform at a lower price per kilowatt hour to help ratepayer bills. The next element, like I said, is the 225 megawatt cap. While this may seem like a high cap, if you average the amount of megawatts that have been submitted over since the inception of the program, it far out exceeds this. I believe it's closer to 500 megawatts per year. So this would substantially trim the historical number of garden applications. And I think it would also provide a safety buffer if one of the other policy changes in this bill were to unintentionally overheat the market. It would then provide the utility with some relief that they're not going to see another several gigawatts of applications overnight. And then the last issue I want to touch upon is the consumer protections. So the way that this bill was originally written, there were not a ton of consumer protections. Over time, we have heard of various complaints from customers about maybe door knocking or confusion around that. The amount of complaints that I've heard about are remarkably few given how many megawatts of gardens we have and how many customers are participating in this program. But I do believe that what's in this bill leads to some common sense consumer protections that can be applied broadly and ensure that consumers are protected without adding additional costs onto the industry and the community solar garden program or into this new distributed solar generation tariff there as well. So those are the main ones I see. The last thing I'll say, too, is there is a averaging for the rates over the last few years. I could see how folks might believe that that's some sort of way to elevate the rate. What that actually is a way to preserve jobs. The Star Tribune just came out with a story recently that we lost 6% of the solar workers in the state of Minnesota. This followed from some national data. The reason why this occurred is because the community solar program does swing quite a bit with the rate that does seem to change, not dramatically, but enough year to year that sometimes developers will maybe wait a year or two to submit applications as opposed to submitting them when the projects are ready. And because of this variability, people do lose their jobs. Maybe they came from another state, maybe they're here, but people who were employed 2 years ago aren't today, and part of that is just because of the program variability. So that's my plug, too, for the averaging aspect. So that's what I have for you all today. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
The first question is from Representative Spazio.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This first question, can I kind of go to maybe Mr. Schaefer? You talked, obviously your organization focuses on the state of Minnesota. You talked about, we're leading the country with this particular program. Could you shine some light on what other states are doing in particular that would be somewhat close to this program, if there are other programs like this out there, price setting and whatnot?
Madam Chair, Representative Szczesinski, yeah, I think how you define a community solar garden program can really be radically different. So I believe fairly shortly here we're actually going to get dwarfed by a program I heard about in Florida that I think is going to be about a gigawatt and a half. That is more of a utility-owned community solar garden program where the utility effectively creates a utility-scale program and then will find the subscribers on their own or maybe use a developer partner to go acquire those subscriptions. By putting a gigawatt and a half in a field somewhere away, they can capture higher economies of scale, so they're, I think, putting it into their integrated resource plan. But that model is not even all that uncommon with some of the cooperative utilities in Minnesota. They do something similar. I think Conexus will allow customers to get the RECs from their community solar garden program so that those customers can say their house is powered by renewable energy. I mean, there's a lot of places. I think Illinois has a new community solar garden program where kind of the big difference between what they're doing and our program
and kind of what's proposed here. They actually do have the contiguous county requirement lifted in Illinois. They have a lottery for how the applications are submitted, which my experience, lotteries have not been very good. I mean, that, the last time I've seen a lottery in Minnesota was the Made in Minnesota program. But other than that element, it looks like a lot of what Illinois is doing is borrowing from Minnesota and improving upon it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of follow up to that, what kind of a price point are those community, you know, from an Illinois standpoint or Colorado, kind of, and then also what's the potential? What is Florida looking like? I'm guessing that's Florida Power and Lights project that's going together there.
Madam Chair, Representative Swiezinski, so I think that's a great question and one that you could probably ask some of the later testifiers that are working in some of those other states. As a Minnesota SEIA chapter, I do my best to stay up to speed on what's going on everywhere else, but I don't know that level of detail.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just in your earlier testimony, you talked about 4,000 jobs. Approximately of those 4,000, you said a vast majority were part of the community solar. Any idea of what the exact, I mean, obviously that fluctuates from month to month, but would it be 3,000? Would it be 3,500? You know, what is your estimate in relation to that?
Madam Chair, I think Professor Chan had an answer to your last question, too.
Oh, great. I'd be happy to answer. There are about 1.8 gigawatts of community solar across the country. About 650 of that is in Minnesota of the 1,800 megawatts. States vary quite a bit in how they compensate. A lot of the activity of that 1.8 gigawatts is in not just Minnesota, but Massachusetts, New York, and Colorado have significant programs. The Massachusetts and New York programs pay a significant premium relative to Minnesota for community solar. New York has a framework very much like our value of solar. They call it the value of distributed energy resources. And under that framework, community solar programs get an additional compensation above their value to the tune of about 10 to 11 cents. It's quite significant.
Okay. So, Matt, just, you know, from your membership, Madam Chair, part of your organization, you know, if nothing was to move forward, what is your membership saying what happened to community solar in the state of Minnesota? Do we need change? Do they feel like there's a shortage of solar to some extent that we need to have extra programs created? And then the cap, you know, obviously we've only got 600 megawatts in the state, approximately 225 kind of seems, you know, large as an actual cap. Just explain that a little bit.
Madam Chair, Representative Swiezinski, so I'm going to go back to the jobs question first, and then if I miss one of these other two, let me know.
Sure.
So the jobs question, I'd say about two-thirds of the jobs in Minnesota are community solar-based. That is a little bit more anecdotal. The level of jobs work I have isn't quite that granular, but that's what it seems like from what I can gather. So then the next one was the outlook for community solar in the state of Minnesota. So the Community Solar Garden Program is, I guess, it's had this interesting trajectory. It used to be able to co-locate up to 5 megawatts and get something called the applicable retail rate. We've shifted down to 1 megawatt at the value of solar rate, which is on average lower. So continuing on with the 1 megawatt at the value of solar rate, the trajectory I expect for the industry is to grow to about maybe 200, 250 applications this year you'd likely see. And then over time, I think the amount of applications would decrease because the substation space is somewhat limited. Providing for larger projects like you see with the distributed solar generation tariff would allow developers to capture larger economies of scale, which they could then use to make the necessary upgrades to deploy solar going forward.
Madam Chair, if I may, on the question on the cap. So it's only been a four-year program, and so in 2016, there were about 225 megawatts that were built, so essentially equivalent to the cap. In 2018, there was 205 megawatts of applications. As Mr. Schaefer just said, we're expecting above 225 megawatts this year, so it's a real cap. It would function to constrain the size of the program that it might be able to grow.
Madam Chair, you know, I'm obviously fairly new to this committee. When the conversation was happening about community solar when this was first passed, what was it was kind of the conversation when they talked about numbers of actual what they expected. It's my understanding it was maybe in that 25 to 75 megawatts of total, you know, as far as participation. You know, it's my understanding that this is grossly, you know, outgrown any idea of what folks were ever going to be prescribing to. I think the way, because the way businesses really, you know, this was sold as a, you know, hey, let's have, you know, houses prescribe, even though it's a very small portion of the program. Do you recall those exact numbers at all, Madam Chair?
I was not on the committee at the time, so I could not testify to that. So we'll have to check the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe Mr. Eloff, do you remember those conversations at all?
Madam Chair, Representative Swindzinski, I don't remember conversations along those lines from the members, but kind of reading through the history of the program, it's clear that Xcel was certainly surprised at the beginning at the number of applications that came in, and I think it's due to what Mr. Schaefer said, that the decision of the Public Utilities Commission to allow co-location of up to 5 megawatts that stimulated a lot of interest that wasn't thought about when the bill was enacted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Goes to show where our citizens are, doesn't it? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have maybe a question or two for each of the testifiers, and maybe I'll start with Mr. Schaefer. I think I heard you say that the solar pricing is actually dropping by 70%. It's really come down fast. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm kind of just making sure I have my facts right. I think there was just, because I as well, I'm very happy and surprised that solar and the smart folks that are developing it have figured out how to do this a lot cheaper. And that should be a real win for all of us. I think you said 70%, but I think on the back end, I think you said, but as we average out our value of solar issues, we're not seeing that 70% drop over to the ratepayers because we're preserving jobs. Can you make sure I got that right? I wasn't sure if I heard it right. I also sit on the jobs committee, and we have several hundred thousand openings around the state of Minnesota for jobs. And if we're protecting jobs and having ratepayers pay not what I thought was said as a market rate, because it's really come down in solar, I just want to put the connections together so I make sure I have that right. So if you could help me with that, Mr. Schaefer, I'd appreciate that.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, so I think there were two parts in that. One, I'll defer to Gabe on, but the other one I do want to say, so what the Community Solar Garden Program is not just bulk power production. So a lot of the declines in costs that you're referring to have to do with sort of a utility scale build. When you get a smaller project, you can put it on the distribution system, and there's a lot of extra benefits. It's not, while you can build it for far cheaper and put it really far away, the power and the energy that's produced really far away is not as valuable as siting it close to load. So that's one of the benefits of a community solar garden. But what's specifically unique about community solar garden is it does allow for members of the community, churches, schools, some local businesses to participate. And that is an element that does require a little bit of extra cost, that energy freedom, that ability to participate in the democratization of the grid. That is something that does cost a little bit more if you want to have a community solar garden program. So I wouldn't say that we're paying for jobs. I mean, there's plenty of jobs in the utility scale market. But
Madam Chair, if I could, did you make that statement, though, that because it's not coming down like people would assume, it's because there are a lot of jobs here, we want to protect those jobs? I thought that was a statement you made.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, I mean, I would like those jobs protected for sure. But that, I don't think, is the justification for why this committee should look at different pricing. I think jobs are in the solar industry are going to come when you build solar.
And I would agree with that, too. And I think the only thing I want to, I'm not trying to turn this upside down right now. I want to make sure that, and when you say a little bit of a cost increase or the smaller gardens are a reason maybe why there's a little bit of an increase over maybe what I'm assuming is more of a utility scale of solar, I get that. It's the conversation about what is a little bit. Is it 4 cents versus 14 cents? You know, that's a huge amount when it comes to the overall pricing. We're going to have these conversations the next several hours, I'm guessing. So this is kind of the basis of why I'm kind of going with this, and I appreciate your comments on that. My question to Dr. Chan, if I could, I think again, I want to make sure I heard this right. You had shared with the committee that your statement, and maybe I'll have you reread it, or if I missed it and we don't have time, you can share your written testimony. I'd appreciate that very much so I don't get it wrong. But that we're not displacing, we're not sharing the higher rates with non-subscribers, that is not happening to other users. Can you either go back to that, make sure I have that right, or maybe just help me understand that question better?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Baker, happy to post my written testimony and share it with you. The intention of the value of solar tariff was to design a payment to solar generators that exactly equals the benefits to the system. That's the intent. And so that means that the value of solar is not tied to the costs of solar. It's tied to the value of solar. And that value may have nothing to do with the costs of solar. It actually has to do with the avoided costs, meaning all the costs that are not incurred because of that solar. And so that means that it's avoiding new natural gas build-out, perhaps. It's avoiding new fuel purchases. It's avoiding the build-out of the poles and wires on the grid. And it's avoiding environmental harms. So all that together is unrelated, necessarily, to the cost of solar. And so as the costs of solar have declined 70% in the last decade, that wedge has grown. And so the question is then, it's a question of public policy of who gets to keep that difference between the costs and the value. And in fact, I think there's been a lot of hard thinking about exactly how that wedge should be shared. And so with the community solar program, the idea is that the subscribers get some of that benefit, the developers get some of that benefit. If the utility were to own these projects, the utility would get some of those benefits, and the ratepayers would get some of those benefits.
So to that point, again, the wedge is what we're talking about, and thank you for that. And I think you're hitting again on something that as we find the costs for not rebuilding up a new unit, a new plant, we aren't recognizing those savings. So if we want to put up a solar farm next to a pole that can grab the energy, why is it the mentality is that we have to take those savings of other plants that are not going to be built? Why is it that we just can't enjoy the full savings or 90% of that savings instead of having a 4 cents to a 14 cents? That is where I'm trying to get to so that we see this protection of folks that are forced to pay higher rates because they can't afford to be on the system. But that's that wedge we need to talk about a lot. And so I want to understand, why can't we, instead of celebrating not having to build more plants, why are we still not taking advantage of this great technology and getting it cheaper on the grid so that we can all have a happy dance? That's the part that I'm trying to get around. And I wish smarter people than I would have come to me ahead of time so I could have asked all these questions before today's meeting, because I just really want to understand this business model of not celebrating our technology. It's like we have saved so much money on our laptops and devices over the last 10, 15 years, but we've actually seen the lowering of pricing of technology. We aren't putting it somewhere else where it isn't doing other things. So help me with that, if you would, please. And that's my last question for now.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Baker, I think you've raised some important questions. There are some matters of public policy and values about who has opportunity that I think are outside of my expertise. But I will say a few things to maybe add a little bit more nuance here to the way you can think about this, which is that one is that the avoided costs embedded in the value of solar are designed to make whole the non-participants, meaning that there are no net costs to the system. So it's designed to just get back to where the rates would have been except for these community solar programs. So that's the notion, is that keeping all the non-participants whole and potentially creating some benefits for those who subscribe. But then there's also one additional complexity, which is that distributed generation has a set of benefits that are actually quite difficult to quantify and quite difficult to value in the sort of regular procurement processes. So if the utility were to own and build out distributed generation, it can be quite hard to value the avoided distribution system benefits and also the avoided environmental benefits. And in particular, that sort of the smaller scale distributed resources has for a long time in federal statute, almost 40 years almost, have recognized that smaller resources need a different way to come onto the grid than large resources because those benefits are more diffuse and harder to quantify.
And thank you for expanding that a bit and for posting your testimony today. If it could be posted soon or if I can get a copy, if I refer back to your notes during our conversation about this, we're going to be asking the members to take some really challenging questions during the next few hours about this bill because, again, there's some good ideas here. There's some innovation that I think needs to be shared, but I want to make sure that I don't misspeak for you later on. I just want to get it right. So thank you very much for your time.
Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions, I think, for Dr. Chan. And question one is, you mentioned something about environmental harms are avoided, but take a step back with me, if you could, and help me from a 20,000-foot level. What are the environmental harms that we are avoiding versus I have people calling me and asking about land being tied up with large solar projects and some of the issues with contamination at the point of manufacturing. So help me to understand the difference between the two and the value of one versus the detriment of the other.
Madam Chair, Representative Bowe, thank you for this question. I guess there's a slight nuance here between the actual harms avoided and the harms that are quantified and put into the tariff. Those are designed to be aligned as close as possible. There can be some differences. So in the actual tariff design, there are several different air-related environmental harms. And it's carbon dioxide and particulate matter, which drive quite a bit of the calculation. There's also sulfur dioxide and NOx. And there is a separate docket at the Public Utility Commission with quite a bit of scientific evidence inserted on how to quantify those environmental benefits. Benefits can be thought of as equivalent to avoided costs. And so those costs are based on, for carbon emissions, a federal interagency working group to develop the social cost of carbon. And the particulate matter, which is driving another significant part of the environmental harms, is driven by a scientific study estimating the impact of particulate matter mostly on respiratory-related diseases.
Thank you. And so the assumption is those emissions are coming from older technology plants, coal, et cetera.
That's right. So it's based on the emission factors on the grid. And so in particular, the way the current methodology works is based on offsetting a natural gas power plant. In practice, solar gardens are displacing energy off of the MISO, the Mid-Intercontinental System Operators grid. And so when those emissions, when solar comes on, it's displacing other resources from generating, and that's avoiding emissions there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it still troubles me a bit, though, that it seems like this, the bigger picture, it's a benefit for society, which is a positive, but it seems like that's kind of borne on the backs of the ratepayers of, like, Xcel, who's buying a lot of the energy coming from the solar gardens. And so, you know, how do we justify charging the few for the benefit of the many?
Yeah, thank you for that question as well. So the notion of who pays for environmental harms is also a matter of public policy, right? That there is, I think, a well-established notion that when there is harm, the efficient way to compensate for those harms is to charge the polluter or to charge the system so that there's an incentive that aligns the social damages with the cost. And so that's the notion here. But you're right that there are social benefits created by avoiding pollution that occurs not even just in Minnesota, but globally, if we think about climate change. And those are being paid for by the system. And so in this case, because of the way the fuel clause is designed, that's all ratepayers. But another way I would sort of add to that conversation is that there are a lot of harms right now that are not being paid for. And so there's inefficiency there. That asthma in the state is not being paid for. That's being paid for through our health care bill. And climate change is being paid for across the world.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, one last question, if I could. Or this was my second question, actually, originally. Thank you. I've heard two different terms that have me kind of confused. One is value of solar, and one is, you know, the retail cost for solar. And how does the community solar garden program, how does that compare if you try to look at one point in time with the value of solar versus the retail pricing of solar? And how do we make that conversion between the two?
Yes, so thank you for this question as well. The value of solar was established as a framework in the 2013 legislation based on the total value created by solar. Great name. The retail rate is what we pay for electricity, and there's yet one more nuance, the applicable retail rate, or the ARR, which was how solar gardens that applied for permitting in 2015-16 were compensated. The applicable retail rate was tied to the retail rate. It's not exactly the retail rate, mostly due to a difference in payments for renewable energy credits, or RECs. So that difference between the retail rate and the applicable retail rate is mostly due to the REC payment, but they move together very closely. The value of solar is unrelated to the retail rate in the way it's calculated.
Yeah, it makes sense in a way, but yet it's very complicated to do an apples to apples across the board, isn't it? Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Macklin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You two are going to help us get educated here because we get a lot of questions about this, and it's very complex. I want to start with Mr. Schaefer. You just made a comment a little bit ago in your statement that by having community solar, it can be kept closer to base load need versus being like a utility solar program in a field that's out in the middle of nowhere. Can you help me visualize what you mean by that? Like, where is the base load need that you see that's where you can put community solar versus where would that utility solar field be that's so far away?
Madam Chair, Representative Meckland. I think the easiest one to understand, at least for me as a non-engineer person, is line losses. So if you have a big power plant over here and your city's over here, as the electricity moves across the line, you lose electricity to the air. So just like it comes off the power lines, is the impression I get. And so you actually have to make more energy over here to pump it across all the way to the city. Whereas if you can just put the solar over here, you don't have to pump it as far, and so you don't really need as much. And so it's kind of more valuable there. So that's one element. Another element is as again, I'll use kind of an analogy on this one for educational purposes, sort of like as you're pumping it across the line, you might need a bigger sort of pipe. Like if you envision like a sink where water is going down it and the water going through is the energy, you also need to have the pipe be a certain size. So that's like the capacity. If you don't have a big enough capacity, it'll back up and clog, right? So solar kind of is like that on the grid, where if you put it closer to the load, you're sort of increasing the capacity in that area. And so you're providing an additional benefit on the distribution system by removing some of their capacity constraints. Beyond that, there are several other ones that are really even more complicated than that, but that's kind of the general gist.
Representative Meckler.
Madam Chair, thank you. So, okay. So I think what you're telling me, and I think what I'm understanding is we have like the metro area has the bigger need. And so by being able to put smaller solar in that area is a benefit rather than having it way out in the middle of nowhere. I think that's kind of what I'm picturing here.
Madam Chair, Representative Meckler. Yeah, that's correct. And the way the community solar garden program currently works, all the gardens are basically like in the metro or in the counties that are surrounding it. So they're relatively close to the metropolitan area. And that is presumably a better benefit to the utility. Because technically the value of solar is really the value of distributed solar. And it's to capture those distributed benefits.
Madam Chair. So that's what I thought you were saying. So if that's the case, why do we want to remove the contiguous county barrier that would now allow this to be put much further away when the need is in down here?
I'll just give one example. So Ramsey County right now has difficulty accessing some of the counties that have been good for solar development, and I think you'll hear from a testifier later today about that, because they are on the east side, and a lot of the available land has been counties to the west. So Hennepin County isn't necessarily the best county for development for Ramsey, but there are options that are still within the metro that would allow Ramsey customers to participate.
Madam Chair. Maybe this would go to, I think you cleared some of that up. I'm sure as I think this through and formulate this in my head, I might come up with some more. But earlier, this is to Representative Long, Professor Chan made a comment that there currently are no subsidies for solar, I believe, is in your original statement.
I said the value of solar is an unsubsidized rate, which means that the basis of the tariff is on the total value created. So subsidy would be when the tariff is above the value it creates.
Madam Chair, so if there's no, if I'm understanding this right, if there's no subsidy in the value of solar, why do we need a cap?
Madam Chair, that's a great question. I don't want a cap, but I do want the program to succeed. And as it is right now, we're fighting year after year at the Public Utilities Commission. So this is a good faith effort on my part, I think, to try to get to a compromise.
One more question, Madam Chair. So one other thing that out of all this, does the value of solar, does that take into account the cost of CO2? Is that factored into that value?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure which one of the panel this will go for, but community solar gardens. I live in East Central Minnesota. I'm part of the co-op there. Is this, you know, is community solar gardens, are they only with Xcel? Do other co-ops or munis have them in the state? Sure. Or can you give a little bit of a explanation of what, how this works or what's going on?
Madam Chair, Representative, so there are, I think, maybe like about 25 cooperative community solar gardens in the state. There's Minnesota Power has one as well. And then Xcel has the vast majority of them.
Okay. Another question I have is, what's kind of the life expectancy of a solar garden? You know, is there probably maintenance or?
Sure.
What's the lifespan of one?
So typically panels are warrantied for 25 years, but you can get 5 to 10 even years after that before they really run out of their ability to produce. Yeah.
And kind of follow-up question to that, at the end of their life, you know, what happens? Are they recycled? What's the next process?
So that's a great question. Right now, the value, we believe the value in the panels is sufficient to, and the extra years of productivity will allow for reuse and recycling that's profitable right off the bat. But because we're not 100% certain on that, we're actually engaging right now with the Pollution Control Agency to figure out the best way to work on recycling bills. And I know that there was a bill filed this year about that topic, and so we're going to continue to work with the PCA as the Solar Association to make sure that before 2025, when Xcel starts putting in their utility-scale plants, that there's a plan for how to handle the hundreds of acres of panels we'll see at that point.
Kind of follow-up question to that. You know, as I mean, technology is rapidly changing, and then, you know, cost of recycling changes. And I'm just wondering, is there any thoughts of having any fiscal assurance in this to, you know, when the day comes that these panels need to be decommissioned, what happens at that point?
So that is being explored. I think at this point, because of the module pricing, the ability to do reuse, and the valuable metals within it, that should cover it. But we're willing to explore all options to make sure that we don't end up with these things getting landfilled, unless that's okay.
Thank you. Representative Swazinski, I think you have the last question.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of, you know, we're talking a little bit about this kind of avoided cost and environmental benefits. And it seems to me that Xcel ratepayers, to some extent, don't see avoided environmental benefits, but society sees the benefits. But Xcel ratepayers essentially pay for them. Does that kind of make sense?
Thank you for this question. So I think that this is correct, that with the value of solar tariff, that the solar gardens are being compensated for environmental benefits. But I think at the same time, other fossil generators are not paying for the damages that they're creating. And so I think that those two need to move in tandem. And I would add also that, you know, in some of the analysis that we've submitted to the Public Utility Commission, there's some challenges in the methodology with exactly how to calculate those environmental benefits. As you can imagine, it's very difficult to figure out what climate damages would be or asthma from particulate matter. We know roughly what those are, but it's hard to do that attribution. And in fact, a lot of our analysis is showing that some of the assumptions in the methodology deep in the weeds are actually undervaluing some of the environmental benefits in the short run, but also are not adaptable to the fact that the grid is cleaning up overall, and really we should be taking that into account as well.
Madam Chair, just kind of a question to the researcher. So what do you think, if we were to account for the benefits, would be a proper amount? So we put a value on the benefits, the environmental benefit for, what do you think the proper price would be for fossil fuel if you were to calculate that? I'm sure you've probably done that on the side.
Yeah, thank you. This is a very complicated question. The damage numbers are usually reported per ton of CO2, and so it would take a bit of math and data to figure that out, but it would be very large. It would be substantial to figure out exactly what the total particulate matter damages and CO2 damages are. I don't want to be on the record at the moment with what that number is, but it would be significant.
Thank you. Thank you for the testifiers and answering all the questions. I think it was important that we get all of these questions answered. We would now like to invite up XL, and I am cognizant of the time and that there are a lot of public comments. If somebody who wants to comment publicly, because we can't go tonight, if you can't come back on Thursday, would you please let us know? Representative Straczynski.
Madam Chair, if someone traveled a distance too, it might be good too for them. So.
Well, yes, let us know. Let us know.
Madam Chair, I have a handout if we can have a page, pass them around. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. I know that Holly Hinman also shows up on your agenda, and Holly turned out to have a work to do back in the office, so you're stuck with me, and I'll do the best I can, and I do have some resources here to help me answer questions in case they come up. I'd like to especially thank the chair for giving us some extra time this morning to talk about this. This is a very important program to XL and its customers because XL customers are the only Minnesotans who are subjected to this program. You've heard talk about other community solar garden programs in the state, and there are other programs that are called community solar gardens, but no other program in the state of Minnesota, and very few, if any, around the country, are designed the way this program is designed, a program where our customers are required to pay triple the cost of solar energy in an unlimited quantity that comes onto our system regardless of whether we need it or not. We have three concerns with the Community Solar Garden Program and with the way the programs are expanded in the current bill. First of all, the financial transaction, as I'm going to talk about in a minute, is extremely regressive. It takes money from the poor and it gives money to the rich. That's just the way the money flows. It wasn't the design, it wasn't the intention, but it's the way the money flows. Secondly, these inequities are caused by the fact that we have priced this energy in a structure where it is unconnected to market prices, and, as Professor Chan said, it's unconnected to cost. Large for-profit companies get paid three times the cost of solar energy and get to retain that regardless of how much it costs them to produce the commodity that they're selling. And I'll talk a little bit about that. And then third, I'll talk about the fact that this program is having a tremendous impact on our, a negative impact on our customers in an extremely regressive way. And the provisions of the bill that we're talking about today would only make matters worse. So first of all, I'd like to direct your attention to the three bars on the front of this handout so that I can talk a little bit about how the money flows. Regardless of the intention, regardless of how this was set up, this is just a fact of how the money flows. All Xcel Energy customers, represented by the green bar on the left, pay the value of solar rate for community solar garden energy. That's about three times the cost of solar energy that we could acquire on the market. All customers pay it. Our CNI customers, our small business customers, our government customers, and our residential customers. About 20% of our residential customers are low-income customers, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a minute. But they all pay. They all pay three times the cost, three times the market cost of solar energy. Where does the money go? It goes to the next bar. These are the CSG subscribers. This is a very tiny subset of our customers who get this benefit. So the entire value of solar rate, triple the cost of energy, is transferred to these customers. As you can see, 62% of those are commercial and industrial customers of ours, businesses, Walmart, Target. These are the companies that get the three times the rate of solar paid to them by our customers. Another 25% are local governments and schools, City of Minneapolis, Minneapolis School District, places like that. And 13% of the recipients of this high-priced energy, the payment for this high-priced energy, are residential customers. And I mentioned our low-income customers, and it's important to keep in mind that except for a very small fraction of that 13% that go through the cooperative energy futures kind of a model, low-income customers are not invited to participate in that middle segment. They are not permitted to become subscribers. And I'll explain why that is. There's a perfectly logical business reason why that's true. I'm not sure it makes sense as a policy reason, but there's a perfectly logical business reason. Most solar developers who build community solar gardens will not invite low-income customers to join. And the reason is really the next green arrow going over to the last box. While those small number of subscribers get the money from all of our customers, they don't get to keep it all. They get to keep only a portion of it, and the balance they have to send to the community solar garden owners. Well, you can imagine if you're an investor and you want to become one of these community solar garden owners over on the right-hand side, you don't want to have to chase low-income customers. You don't want to have to deal with people who have trouble paying their bills. You don't want to have people who don't have good credit ratings. Your investment's not very good if you can't collect the money. And so, for a very sound business reason, you want those people in that middle bar to be large companies that pay their bills on time, that are going to be around for 25 years, and that you're not going to have to chase. So this wasn't the intention when the program was set up, but for very sound business reasons, you can see why it developed that way. Frankly, residential customers are a pain to deal with. If I can get paid by Target or Walmart or the City of Minneapolis, I know I'm going to get paid, I know I'm going to get paid on time, and I know that they're going to be around for 25 years. So, of course, I'm going to prefer them as the beneficiaries of this overpayment for energy. And so we've created this, and then to go to that last bar, as you can see what's happened is, this is a very lucrative investment. I will tell you that Xcel Energy, a non-regulated subsidiary of Xcel Energy, owns 17 megawatts out of the 800 and some megawatts that we have of solar gardens. So we know we earn a higher rate of return selling solar garden energy to our same customers than the PUC allows us to earn with our regulated customers. This is a very lucrative program, and that's why 67% of it are owned by large corporations outside of the state of Minnesota who see a really good investment. If someone's willing to overpay for something, lots of people will sign up to provide it. And that's really what's happening in this program. 20% of the owners of solar gardens aren't even in the country. And all of that value is leaving the state of Minnesota, going to those businesses. I think we talked about this last year when we had a hearing on this bill. The largest single owner of solar gardens in the state of Minnesota is Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett knows a good investment when he sees it. He knows a high rate of return when he sees it. He owns a regulated utility in Iowa. He gets a higher rate of return from Minnesota customers on this energy than the Iowa PUC allows him to earn in Iowa. So, of course, he's going to come in here and buy this stuff. Now, I don't want to mislead. The people in this last bar here on the right side, they don't get to keep all of that money. It's not pure profit that flows through to them because they've got to pay to run the solar garden. They've got to maintain it. They've got to operate it. They've got to, you know, collect the bills from the subscribers and all of that sort of thing. So it's not pure profit. But as Professor Chan mentioned, the cost of operating the system is totally unrelated to the price that they're connecting. The price is based on the value of solar calculation, which has nothing to do with how much it costs to run the system, which is why it's a good investment, frankly. If someone's willing to overpay you extremely, you know, much over your costs, of course you'll get a lot of people to sign up. This transaction, by the way, between the second bar and the third bar is totally unregulated. We don't know. You don't know, I don't know, the PUC doesn't know. Nobody knows what goes on inside that box. Nobody knows how much is kept by the subscribers in the middle box, and nobody knows how much profit is being made by the owners in the third box, because there's no relationship between their costs and their income, and it's a non-regulated transaction. They get to keep as much as they can bargain for with the subscribers in the middle box. Our concern with the bill that's before you today is, first of all, for community solar gardens, it triples the size of the gardens that can be allowed from 1 megawatt to 3 megawatts, so that this effect that we have, which again, I want to repeat, is an unintended consequence. No one, I was here in 2013, I worked very hard on the community solar garden bill. It was never the intention that this kind of a transfer of wealth that you're seeing here would happen in this program. It's a consequence of the business. Once you get in business and you see where the money flows, of course, this is the way it ended up. But this was not the intention when we established this program. But what we're doing now in this bill is we're tripling the size of it. We're tripling the size of the wealth transfer from our customers to the people down in the second box and the people in the third box. By removing the contiguous county requirement, we're expanding the opportunities for these to be developed. We're doing nothing about the cost. The cost is still staying the same in this bill. In addition to that, we add, under this bill, a distributed energy program. Now, it's a slightly lower cost. It's the value of solar minus the environmental benefits. But it's still double the price of energy on the market. And you can bet that the same players that you see in this third box over here are going to come running to Minnesota and say, if I can get paid double the price of solar, guess what? I'll sign up. And we'll see this. And what our fear is, we're going to see the same thing. You'll just take out the middleman. The middle bar goes away. And the money will flow directly from our customers to these investors who come in and build these things because they can get paid double the price. Again, completely unassociated with how much it costs them to provide what it is they're providing. In addition, the bill creates a new, requires Xcel Energy to apply the value of solar tariff to commercial industrial customers who put rooftop installations on their buildings. Currently, those customers get net metering, the same benefit that residential customers will get. Under this bill, they will get even more. They will get the value of solar, which is higher than what they would realize on net metering. They may also be participating in our solar rewards program, in which case they're getting an additional subsidy from our customers. But the point is that Section 2 of this bill will actually increase the amount of money that has to be paid by our customers only to commercial and industrial customers who put solar panels on their roof. So, in total, the bill really seems to greatly increase the possibilities, the opportunities for this wealth transfer from our customers to the for-profit businesses that develop and own these systems. So I want to talk a little bit about this value of solar, because this is part of the root of the problem, which is that the value, and I've talked a little bit about it already, the value of solar, this high price that we are paying for this energy, is what essentially makes this a very lucrative program for the owners, very lucrative for the subscribers, and very costly for our customers. And first of all, I've already touched on, but I'll touch on it again. The price that we are paying and the price that ends up going to the owners of these systems is totally unrelated to their cost. We don't know if they're making a windfall profit, a modest profit, a tiny profit. I assume they're making some profit because they're still signing up to do it. But we have no idea because we don't connect the price we pay to the cost. If I were looking for an analogy for this, and the reason we do that is because instead of basing it on a market price or basing it on some percentage over cost the way a utility does, we go in for a rate case, we say this is how much it costs, you give us a modest profit on top of that, and then that's set, but it's related to the cost. In this case, the cost of building the systems and the price they get for it never touch each other. They're completely unrelated, and that's because we establish the cost based on a notion of value. Well, the notion of value is highly subjective. We've seen instances in our society where a drug manufacturer has a drug, maybe it's a life-saving drug, and he says, well, I'm going to charge $25,000 a dose. That's its value. If you're going to die, if the alternative is dying, maybe you'd pay $25,000. That's the value of it. It may cost me only $15 to make the dose, but if I'm going to price it based on value rather than on the cost of producing it, why shouldn't I? And I think we all react to that somewhat and say, well, wait a second. We don't price things in this society based on value. We price things in this society based on cost or based on market competition. But to choose an arbitrary number, a subjective number, and say, well, that's the value of what you're getting, so you should be happy to pay for it, we would get the same value. We would get all those environmental benefits, all those transmission benefits, all those distribution benefits if we bid this, or if we connected the cost of building it to the price that people are paying. We'd still get all those benefits, but we'd be paying considerably less for it. The value of solar is also, to be honest, arbitrary. And we know this because we've had experience with it. The first couple of years when they used the value of solar, the developers came into the PUC and said, it's not enough. We can't build this stuff for the value of solar. And so the PUC put adders on top of the value of solar and said, okay, we'll give you the value of solar plus something. Well, if this formula for the value of solar is such a great thing and so accurate and so precise and so objective, why do the developers have to come in and say, well, this year it's not quite enough? And then last year we had the opposite. Actually, in 2020, we had the opposite situation. When they put the numbers through the formula for the value of solar, it actually came out to $240-some a megawatt hour. That's like, I don't know, right now we're paying 115, so you can imagine. It went up to 240. That's the way the formula worked. The PUC said, that's outrageous. We can't give people that much money. This thing will go through the roof if you're paying that much money. And so they, not arbitrarily, but they adjusted the methodology so they could get down to a price of $115, three times the cost of solar, but still $115 instead of $240. So you can see that this value of solar proposition is somewhat arbitrary, somewhat subjective, and it's totally unrelated to the cost of developing this. And this is why the program has a problem. If you look on the back of the handout I gave you, the line chart at the top, this gives you some idea of what the discrepancy is that we're looking at here. The solid lines arching up from the left to the right indicate the value of solar rate. The value of solar rate has an inflator built into it, so that's why the lines curve up as we go off into time. But you can see in 2017, the value of solar rate was higher. In 2018, it came down a little. In 2019, it came down a little more. In 2020, it went very slightly back up. So that's what the value of solar is doing. The blue dots in the lower left-hand corner indicate the price decrease in solar energy that we're seeing in the market. This is the market price of solar energy compared to the value of solar price of solar energy. So you can see why Warren Buffett is running to Minnesota to sell energy to our customers for an inflated price. He'd be crazy not to. We expect, if you look at our resource plan, we expect those blue dots to fall even more. We believe by the middle of the decade, those blue dots will actually represent the lowest cost energy that we have. But there's absolutely no indication that the value of solar is going to follow suit because, again, the value of solar is not in any way connected to the market and it's not in any way connected to cost. It's an arbitrary number calculated through a formula that is then delivered to private for-profit companies to provide this energy. The last thing I'd like to touch on, maybe the second to last thing, is that we have seen the impact of this. Our customers are seeing the impact of this. I should go back and just, I want to mention one thing back on the front of the, on this chart here. You'll notice who's not on there. XL Energy is not on there. We are kind of a stranger to this transaction. This is all done through a pass-through. So we do actually collect the money from our customers in the green bar and deliver it to the customers in the middle. But we don't put any more money in. We don't take any money out. It's just a pass-through. So we're a passive participant in this process. So our customers are starting to see the impact of this program. And if you look at the chart on the bottom of the page, you'll see what that impact is. In 2015, we didn't have any solar gardens, so they were providing zero energy, and they were costing zero energy. They were costing us zero, our customers zero. This year, we expect that 21% of our fuel charge will be community solar gardens. So just to back up for a second, what the fuel charge is a portion of our customers' bills. It reflects the price that we pay for fuel for our system, coal, gas, nuclear, uranium. It also reflects the price we pay third-party providers through power purchase contracts are reflected on here. So you see, for example, in 2015, the cost of solar was 32% of the fuel charge, delivered 28% of the energy on our system. If you look down to wind back in 2015, that's not actually a fuel charge. We're just purchasing energy from wind developers who've built those wind farms. It cost 18% of the fuel charge and provided 15% of the energy. So now look at the change that has occurred in the 5 years that are represented on these charts. Wind is a remarkable success. It's now at 16% of the cost, but providing 27% of the energy. Look at nuclear. We've spent a lot of time trying to get the price of nuclear down. It's gone from 11% of the cost with 25% of the energy to only 9% of the cost at 28% of the energy. So we're trying to drive these costs down. Another one that you know, thank yourself for this, thank the legislature for this, biomass. In 2015, 13% of the fuel cost was coming from biomass plants, but only 2% of the energy. 3 years ago, working with the legislature, we got out of two of our three largest biomass contracts. And look at the result. Instead of 13%, it's now costing our customers only 5% of their fuel charge, but we're still only getting 1% of the energy. If you look at solar gardens, you can see the impact this is having on our customers. 21%, the second highest, actually tied for first highest number, in the fuel charge that flows directly through to our customers in order to get 3% of our energy. Under this bill, that's only going to get worse. The share of the fuel, I mean, frankly, even if this bill doesn't pass, community solar gardens, if they're going to grow the way some of the proponents have talked about, we're going to see that number diverge. And if this bill were to pass, it would diverge even more. We would see larger and larger amounts of cost for smaller and smaller amounts of energy. XL Energy has, as you all know, set the goal of getting to 100% carbon free by 2050. The single biggest impediment to doing that, the biggest pushback we get from our utility companies around the country to our customers here in Minnesota, is on cost. How much is this going to cost? How much are we going to impact climate change for the cost? How much is it? We've heard it on this committee. A lot of focus on cost. It's the single biggest thing that we have to deal with when we go out and try to promote our plan for 100% carbon-free energy by 2050. So much so that our CEO has added to that pledge, we'll get to 100% carbon-free by 2050 without our customer bills going up more than the rate of inflation. That's the promise that we've made to balance this cost. Community solar gardens and the proposals in this bill just make that harder. You can see in the chart I handed out, all of the savings from biomass have been eaten up by solar gardens. All of the savings on wind, the dropping of wind prices, have been eaten up by solar gardens. Our customers are not recognizing any of those savings because they are overpaying for energy in this one program that provides 3% of their energy. I understand there's members of the legislature and members of this committee who would like Xcel Energy to go faster and bigger in deploying solar than what we've put in our resource plan. We can do that. We can sit down and put together programs that do that, if that's the policy that the legislature wants to pursue. And we can do it in a way that is far more fair to our customers, that is far lower cost than what's being done through the Community Solar Gardens Program and through the other programs proposed in this legislation. Again, Madam Chair, thank you so much for your giving me the time to go through that. I do appreciate it very much, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Before we take questions, a number of people have signed up for public comment, and we don't have much time left, and I want to make sure that those folks who've signed up can come back on Thursday, and if they cannot come back on Thursday, I'd like to have them come up now.
Madam Chair, I just let you know, I will definitely be here on Thursday.
Pardon?
I will definitely be here on Thursday.
I figured. Are there people who have signed up who would like to testify now? They may do so. Why don't you come up and testify now? Yes. Folks should not just take a minute or two and testify, but welcome to the committee, and thank you for the
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Timothy Denner-Thomas. I'm General Manager of Cooperative Energy Futures. We are a member-owned community energy co-op based in Minneapolis, but with members across Minnesota. We right now have about 840 members. We have developed over 6.5 megawatts of solar, 8 different projects, including in urban, suburban, and rural Minnesota. We are member-owned, so all of our subscribers are members of our co-op and therefore members of the projects that we develop. Over 85% of our solar gardens by subscribed capacity are residential, so we are very focused on ensuring that the benefits of this program go to Minnesota community members. We really believe that clean energy should be available to all and that it should benefit local communities, particularly people who are most impacted by energy poverty and high energy cost burdens. We are very focused as a cooperative on really making sure that the benefits of community solar go to low-income households, low-income families. We have a project just outside of St. Cloud where some of the members are residents of a manufactured housing park in Fridley. And same project has residents in the Somali community in St. Cloud itself. One of our projects down in Waseca County, just outside of Janesville, has subscribers that are affordable housing residents in Mankato, as well as residents in another manufactured housing park in Northfield. We have a project right in the center of downtown Minneapolis, the Ramp 8 Community Solar Garden, that is subscribed by a number of low-income residents, including renters, affordable housing residents, of a variety of similar subscribers in the metro area. We really believe that community solar should be developed in and as much as possible by communities and really should benefit a broad range of people. We are here to support House File 3368 as amended. We believe that there are many pieces in here that are important for the solar industry and that there are many different parts of the solar industry that need to be benefited. And we think a lot of the things that have already been said around how the shift to value of solar has already made a very significant difference in moving away from a lot of the concerns around high cost that have preceded the program to date, and that have really mitigated those concerns because of the way that what people are paying now into community solar matches the value that is being provided to ratepayers as a whole. We specifically wanted to talk about the community access project designation. This is in Section 3, Subdivisions 4 through 6 of the DeLeol amendment that was put forward. This is a provision that's really trying to address this question of residential participation. So we've already heard today that the vast majority of community solar by capacity that has been developed so far has not been serving residents, and we also heard that the vast majority that has served residents has used a credit score as a barrier, which has limited a lot of low-income people participating. As a developer, we're almost the inverse of that picture. Again, 85% of our customers are residential. We've had some analysis that somewhere between 38 and 51% of our subscribers by capacity are low-income. We really believe that this is a huge piece of what community solar was supposed to do. We saw community solar as a need. We've seen this, and I've heard from many elected officials as well as other stakeholders in the industry that the original reason that we did this was in large part because if you're a homeowner or a business with a lot of upfront capital and you have your own roof and you can orient it the right way, you can invest in solar yourself. But if you're a renter or if you're a low-income household, or if your roof doesn't face the right way, or doesn't have the right structural capacity, or you don't have the access to, take out a $10,000 or $20,000, even higher if it's small commercial property, financing for solar, you need a way that solar can work for you. And that was really, in our opinion, the intent of this program. We're very excited about other dimensions of this bill as it relates to the solar industry as a whole. But we particularly wanted to emphasize the importance of an element of the program that restores access to residents and that safeguards that low-income access and participation. I will stop there, and if there are any questions, I'm happy to take them.
Representative Swazinski has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, I appreciate your testimony. It sounds like you, as the way you're set up as a cooperative or kind of a co-op, probably close aligned with maybe the conversations that were happening when this program first started, where a vast majority of folks were residential. How do you feel from the previous testifiers when a vast majority of this program is being used by out-of-state large corporations?
I could say a lot about that, but I'll try and keep it brief. I think we see this problem from a number of lenses. One is, I think we really appreciate the rapid development of solar that has happened under this program. I think the transition we have seen towards renewable energy has been a very important step and has helped the solar industry get on its feet. We are also very concerned about the potential concentration of wealth and concentration of control and the way that many Minnesotans have been left out of that. I think we are not really seeing this as much that we should stop the opportunity at fair value to ratepayers to develop solar in all sorts of other ways. We think that is a great opportunity for the industry and something that should continue. But we have to make sure that people aren't being left out, that the community solar program, and, there's been discussions, do we want to use things like the distributed generation tariff for other sectors of the market, things like community solar for, more of that residential intent? There's a variety of ways that policymakers could decide to manage that. I think we just need to make sure that there is a priority and there's a focus on ensuring residential and low-income access and looking at other ways to develop the solar industry, through other parts of the community solar garden program, through the distributed generation tariff, in a way that benefits ratepayers as a whole.
Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I think there are two other folks that are standing who would like to testify. Please come forward and put your name on the record.
My name is, can you hear me? David Haig. I'm a resident of Minnetonka, Minnesota.
As I mentioned, resident of Minnetonka, when I first learned about community solar as a resident, it seemed almost too good to be true. Like all of us here who are Xcel customers, that's sort of the default choice. That's what you are. You live in an area, you have one choice. And when I heard I had more choices and it could potentially save me money and it was good for the environment, I didn't dismiss it, but I was suspicious of it. Like, what does this mean, really? And when I did look into it, I saw what it is, which is, competitive companies innovating in a space that had not been innovated in, offering a new choice to customers and giving them a better option, which is what I didn't have before. So for the first time ever, instead of being a passive consumer, I got to make a choice about my energy supply. So I signed for a subscription with U.S. Solar, one of the providers, in August of 2018. The sign-up process was very simple, as simple as anything else I've ever done with my electricity supply, if not more so. U.S. Solar answered a few of the questions that I had, but the process was straightforward enough that I didn't really have many complicated questions. My garden, I looked it up, it's Wright Kirby in Monticello. It's now up and running about almost three quarters of a year, and I'm on track to save about $200 this year as a solar garden participant. And that's real money. That's not just an idea of money. That's actual money that I'm saving. We're supporting renewable energy, and that's something that our community and my household wants to do. It's obviously better than extracting and burning gas and coal. And all the local jobs I understand that come with it are important to me, too. I have some friends in Wisconsin who are aware of the program I'm in, and they're frankly jealous. They have a legislature that's not as forward-thinking as ours. They're not making the same long-term decisions. This is a win-win. Businesses are competing for customers, and they're profiting. Residents are supporting renewals without any upfront costs, and we're creating jobs. We're becoming energy independent. The air we breathe is cleaner. This is logical and obvious stuff, and I really hope it doesn't become any kind of partisan issue. But I'll add this. Changing the perceptions for the majority of residential customers takes time. And I think that's one way I would attribute what's been expressed several times today is there's a lot of corporations that are doing this. Minnetonka, my city, has changed municipal power supply to 100% renewable through the use of solar gardens. That's great. But for every residential household, they have to go through the thought process I did. They have to look through the options and make a choice for a longer span of time. And that's more difficult for an individual to do, at least initially. But when you have a friend or a neighbor that has done it, and they can say, yeah, it worked out great. It's working out great. I still haven't been able to convince my own family members to do this yet. But I do have several friends and neighbors who have signed up. And you can better believe I'm going to go back to my family member, my brother, and say, look, I saved $200 last year. Why aren't you doing this? And hopefully he'll get off the fence and do it. But again, it's because people have been conditioned not to have a choice. They've been conditioned to be passive, conditioned to accept what's there. In fact, the only option I had to support renewables prior to this was to pay extra money for Wind Source, which is a program Xcel has, which would add money onto my bill. And this saves me money and provides the same benefits. So things like this, community solar gardens and companies like U.S. Solar, they're finally changing things. And I hope you'll continue to support this vitally important component of our economy. Thank you.
Thank you. And we will have the next two testifiers, but we've run over time now, so if you could be very brief.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. My name is Tim Brown. I'm a construction program manager with the Public Housing Agency in St. Paul. Public Housing, it's an independent government entity created in the Minnesota legislature in 1977. We're the largest landlord in the city of St. Paul. We own approximately 4,300 low-income units, housing units. We administer 4,700 Section 8 vouchers and house close to 21,000 people. We have 16 high-rises, four family townhome areas, and 400 scattered site units. We've been a HUD high performer for 26 years, providing safe, affordable housing. The PHA has been leading in green initiatives. We've used energy audits to guide improvements with lighting, toilets, windows, insulation, LED retrofit projects, resident initiatives for healthy living, bikes for kids, long-standing practice of community vegetable gardens, resident recycling programs, and now community solar garden subscription agreements. We first learned about the agreements in 2014. We did see the benefit of energy cost reduction, being able to support new renewable energy development. We generated the request for proposals and selected a developer and came up with 37 agreements to take care of all of the capacity, energy capacity in our buildings. That had to be redone or reworked so that only 10 of our buildings were able to be covered. But over the past 3 years, we've seen credits of $107,000 per year that we've been able to put back into our programs. Over the past 4 years, we've been approached by developers to redo, try to get our other buildings covered. It has been kind of a hardship just because of the adjacent county situation. And in short, for us, we do like the community solar program. We've benefited from it. Our residents have benefited from it. And we'd like to complete the subscription agreements, but we will wait till the county expansion rule comes about. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. And the last testifier.
Hello, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Julian White, and I'm one of the founders and owners of Nokomis Partners. I would, like to thank everybody for being here, and more broadly, thank you for working hard to create a more affordable, reliable, cleaner, and safer energy system for the people of Minnesota. Nokomis is a three-year-old energy company focused specifically on community-sited clean energy projects. We currently have 35 megawatts of community solar projects under development in the Excel program. Outside of other developments we have in the state, and that includes 17 gardens that are up and running to date. Some of our customers include government agencies like the Minnesota Department of Transportation, City of Farmington, Goodhue County. We have public schools including Minnetonka, Bloomington, and Faribault, as well as myriad private businesses and residents all local to Minnesota. I'm here in support of lawmakers working to create a framework that gives utilities, ratepayers, regulators, and businesses clarity on the costs of our energy system. Many elements of the bill being discussed here represent important steps in the right direction for Minnesota. This bill recognizes that the value of electricity is different based upon where it is generated on the system, the wholesale system, the distribution system, or behind the customer's meter. This bill also provides Minnesotans transparency by showing where on the system the costs are occurring and what the largest cost elements are each year, allowing better decision-making by our state regulators and utilities. And most importantly, this bill protects ratepayers by only valuing the electricity by the amount at which it reduces the overall system cost, making it more likely that only projects that have the best economics and impact to the ratepayer will succeed. Now, we've heard, I think you're going to continue to hear, and there's going to be a lot of conversation about cost and how is cost handled, and as it relates to past programs, which I agree did not always value energy at the utility's avoided system cost. But I hope that if you remember anything from my testimony this morning, it's that elements of this bill seek to correct that by ensuring that the cost of electricity generation to the ratepayer is based on deploying generation where the economics are best to the system, ensuring that the state and its electricity ratepayers are protected from higher electricity costs. You've heard that the cost is not tied to value. And to be very clear, the value that we get for all of the CSGs that we have deployed is the cost that was calculated in the development of the value of solar, which involved groups like Excel, involved the Department of Commerce, involved a lot of different groups, stakeholders. And that cost is supposed to reflect the cost that the utility does not spend when we deploy that solar. If we believe that that calculation is not accurate, we should continue to invest in working to get it accurate. Because when we site solar to reduce system cost, that cost should then be passed through the community solar project to the subscribers. And the reduction in the subscribers' bill, the amount at which the developer can share savings relative to that cost with the subscriber is a reduction in total system cost. So I want to thank you all for allowing me to come and speak today and working hard on this issue. It's a critical one for Minnesota and beyond, and I look forward to continuing to work with all of you to grow a clean energy economy in Minnesota that is providing great value for all Minnesotans. Thank you for your time.
Thank you all for testifying.
Madam Chair, if somebody had a question for one of the testifiers.
I'm sorry, I didn't see you on the list.
No, I have a question for one of the testifiers.
Okay,
thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I wanted to thank you all for coming. Mr. Haig, I appreciate your story about being a resident of Minnesota. You've got some friends that wish they were Minnesotans, and we will hope they are someday. Tell me, I just want to maybe ask the question to somebody who hasn't ever sat at this chair that I've known before, that is just a residential customer that signed up for this program and you had a good choice and you're saving money. And congratulations to that. My question to you is, do you feel it's appropriate for us to have these conversations because your savings are shifting to other ratepayers? You didn't do anything wrong, trust me. I'm just asking a question. That is the foundation of why we're struggling with this program, because somebody is saving money at the cost of other ratepayers. So my question is, do you feel our conversation in this line is appropriate for the rest of the ratepayers that don't have the ability to be on the system like you are?
Yeah. That's a good question. Obviously, everyone has a different level of information and knowledge and ability to act on that knowledge. And I'm a person who learned about this. I'm fortunate to understand and be aware there's a program and to do the research to find a good option and to participate in it. Again, not every resident is able to do that. That's partly because of the capacity constraints that we're trying to address today by having this more widely available to more people. Everybody makes different choices all the time, but again, when I heard the ballpark figures cited earlier, these are not prohibitive dollars, and moreover, they're being abated as the program design improves. And I hope that the program design that is passed, based on what I understand of it, I'm not an engineer, I'm not in the industry, but that should address a lot of those inequities that you're bringing up. But at the same time, we do want, I think, to move customers to being more responsible people who make better choices about their energy. And better choices comes from more knowledge and more choices. And that's, I think, the fundamental component of it. So it's a roundabout answer to your question, but I hope I understand.
Mr. Haig, I think you're spot on, because I think we all want to find choices of having a lesser footprint here. And I think that's what you are alluding to. And early in your testimony, you said, you know, again, in Minnesota, you don't have a choice. You are an XL customer, but you had other choices to who you can buy your programs from. But that's sort of the thing in Minnesota here, is these folks that are not on the program, they don't have a choice. They have a fuel adjustment clause on their bill. They don't have a choice of what goes in there. And I think that's what we're trying to get to. So because of the monopolies that our service territories have around Minnesota, that's why we are fighting for the people that don't have the opt-in or opt-out of right. The increased rates or the adjustments. And so that's what we're trying to get to, and I just wanted to thank you for being here.
Thank you. And just to clarify, there's a lot of other programs that Xcel offers that customers all directly pay for, but then take out at their own interests. For example, energy efficiency programs that Xcel provides are great, but consumers need to opt into those as well. Xcel can't force customers to take up those. But there are many options that Xcel does provide, and then all ratepayers pay for those. So it's a question of personal responsibility, which I think you could respect.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much for the testimony. We are going to lay this bill over. And let me just tell you what I see as process so that that might answer your question. So we are going to be meeting. Normally, we would continue this hearing in this evening, but we can't because of caucuses. So we are going to be meeting Thursday morning, and we're going to meet in a different room. We're going to be in 500 South. We're going to continue where we left off. We will not be taking any new amendments or any new testifiers, but I think we have ample stuff to work from on Thursday, and that's the plan, is that Representative Buzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the kind of the map moving forward. I would just ask, that was my question, is just from testimony that we heard, just from that group, I kind of had a couple ideas maybe to help fix the bill, and wondered to see if we could maybe change that policy to give us a short window maybe to submit an amendment or two, just from previous testimony and ideas that it may be created, because we do have a couple of days before our next hearing.
Why don't you talk with the author after this hearing?
Sounds good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. We have no other business before us. The bill is laid over until Thursday. Thank you, everybody, for staying late. I appreciate it. Meeting's adjourned.